totally agree that we have not been disappointed by that very wide-ranging, very searching, and original presentation. And Geraint, what I said right at the beginning, these are as timely reflections as they could possibly be. We have some time for questions. I think perhaps about half an hour for questions if you're up for it. And so let's invite some comments before we get started.
Church had a place, but he wasn't naive about the evils that the church could get up to, and it needed a strong magistrate. But equally, he wasn't naive about both the church and the state. You needed a strong vox populi, a strong demos, if you like, we might feel like that, to hold both to account and in structure a process of mutual responsibility and encounter, while at the same time recognizing the importance of the life of virtue to a properly functioning politics. You can't have good politics, good citizens, if they're immoral. And I think what we see played out is that opportunity was never really taken up. It was kind of lost here, some echoes of it, some developments in Dutch Calvinism. But Hobbes represents the other voice, which is, well, we'll solve conflicts by having a kind of, what Hannah Arendt called a command obedience model of power, which completely loses sight of, and it's one of the most extraordinary things in contemporary political theory, right from Hobbes onwards, there's virtually no account of relational power. What is the demos? What are the people? The people are the way in which you have power through associating together for common action, and what is the citizenship tradition, going right back to classical Greece? It places limits on the power of money and on political authority. How do you do that? By associating together for common action. It's the genius insight of the labour movement. What was the labour movement? How do you place limits on organised money? By coming and together and associating, by building relationship together to bring place limits on the power of organised money to determine and commodify your life. And I think that we do see sparks in things like the labour movement and in other forms of associating with life, where the emphasis on mutual responsibility, mutual accountability, and the coming together to bring accountability to bear upon the state and the market. But I think for the most part, our political systems and our political theories have overly focused on sovereignty and a form of command and control understanding of power, unilateral power, which completely disempowers and disaggregates us. So we cease to be a demos and become an oklos or crowd, who are completely vulnerable, for the demands of the market and the state. And I think part of the gift of faith institutions to contemporary politics is a very thin and rather weak flame amongst us of the importance of the congregation coming together for common action that is prior to the market and the state, and values the individual and the social relationship between us as non-instrumentalized, non-commodified. So I think Hobbes represents a deep misstep, and something of what we need to recover, and which I think something like community organizing is part of my interest in it, is precisely the recovery of a genuine account of relational power, and especially in the face of both our parliamentary and our economic crisis.
You're implying, I think, that both the modern left and the modern right, are
sold
on a model of sovereignty, which is essentially toxic for real politics.
Well, I think there has to be, there is a place for sovereign power, and there is undoubtedly a need for it, but it has to be balanced, and something like Aristotle's counterpolitics, I think you see it in Calvin's counterpolitics, and I think we might talk about it in terms of a recovery of a covenantal as opposed to a contractual, the contract being the sovereign individual or the sovereign state, as opposed to a covenantal account. And we need both. You have to have limits, we need rights, but the rights to set the space in which genuine covenantal politics takes place. The ways in which the state acts requires that constant accountability, but it can't be seen to be generating that moral compass itself. It's in one level, it's only ever reflective, and being a good kind of Augustinian, it does bear the sword. It properly does have a coercive role to bring order within the earthly city, like within the disorder we often experience. And while there are better and worse states, undoubtedly better and worse political authorities, and we can look around the world today as an account of them, the state itself and its own processes can't be either A, the generator of that moral compass, or B, we can't turn to the state first. And I think that's often the problem. Both the religious groups you see as a problem for the unions, and for many other groups who formerly had a strong associational and culture of communal self-organisation, and from the kind of system from the post-war period onwards, this first instinct, and I face this working with clergy the whole time, is always to turn to the state, as if that's where we go to get our problems solved, or that's where we go, rather than turning to ourselves, and the state is a question of last resort. I don't know what
thank you very much, Will, for your very inspirational presentation. Hamre wants actually disagree one point in your paper. In one point, you refer to religious extremism. I think we, the faith community, should agree on one point. There is no such thing like religious extremism. Religion is always the balanced way of life. Religion is always peace and tolerance. It is, I think, behavioral extremism, which are byproduct of injustice, deprivation, and intolerance somehow. So I think through religious spirit, we can eradicate this extremism. Number two is faith actually has enormous to contribute in development. And through faith, as you mentioned actually in different way, we can develop a very dynamic and sustainable society and community. And through faith actually, if you can develop sense of accountability to God, which can help to eradicate all these political mess we are currently experiencing in our country. So I think for this, we need to become united as faith community. I think if you shed a light how we can actually make this strong unity and make a well-heard voice in this regard.
Thank you. I mean, I want to completely affirm the second bit of the question. I think I would struggle a bit with the first bit, because I think we have to be honest. There is an interrelationship between certain kind of religious dynamics and resort to violence. There is good and bad religion. We can't just say, you know, every religion is a religion of peace. We have to own, you know, the mad aunt in the cupboard in each of our traditions, if you like. And often they wield an axe, which that's why we keep them locked in the cupboard. So I think we have to be honest about that and how that affects us and within our history, and also our histories of interaction. I think that doesn't, that's often used as an excuse for saying, oh, you know, look how these religious people get all violent when they get into public. Which completely ignores the way in which often political dynamics that set up the very causes of the conflict. I mean, a good quick example of this fantastic study of Southall over 10 years, where Sikh, Muslim, Christian communities have had very good relationships and it's quite convivial working together. And then local council decided to kind of fund some youth at risk projects and set it up in such a way that each group had to identify themselves as a religious group to get a slice of the money. And of course this results in a huge conflict between them, but then when the council kind of analysed it, they thought, oh, look what happens when these religious people get in public, they start fighting this wars of religion all over again, and it completely ignored the way in which they themselves had set up the relationship in a conflictual way. So I think you're right, we do have to be alert to that, but equally, you know, we all have bad histories, and we have to own and take responsibility, and we get beyond the kind of religion, each religion is a religion of peace, to have the point where, like borders, the real points of relationship and exchange and encounter can be met.
I certainly wouldn't want to have Thomas Hobbes as my guru, but I think that the introduction of the concept of sovereignty is very important in the context of what you're saying. And obviously, I found a lot of what you had to say very interesting and indeed very helpful in thinking about the engagement between faith and religion and wider society. I was interested in your phrase about institutional plurality, because I think there is a risk in that. And in particular, I think that we have seen some blurring of the boundary lines in ways which both helpful and unhelpful, between what I would call the political institutions and organisations within civic society. Within civic society, we do need to have a plurality of organisations, and we may want to call them institutions. It's very difficult to have plurality within the political process. It's bad enough having one Westminster Parliament, if we have two, right, life would be even more difficult. Right. And the question is, how does the political process and the political institutions relate to civil society? And I think in many well-intentioned ways in which governments have tried to embrace organisations within civic society, there has been a tendency to blur roles, responsibilities and possibilities. And I think there needs to be a great deal of honesty within the complexity of organisations within civil society about what the legitimacy is of those organisations. And it's perfectly right and proper, for example, for an organisation that is concerned with playing fields to go and see the local authority. It is difficult when an organisation goes to see the local authority to say, we are here because we represent the because that is then making a political claim over and against the existing political institution. And I think that this is one reason why we need both simplicity and complexity in our institutional organisational life. And we need to do a lot more thinking about the different and appropriate roles which different organisations have. So I'd just like your
very number of nests of points there. Very, very helpful, thank you. I think really I want to kind of tease out two issues in what you raise. The first is kind of what I say, relationship to civil space and complex space. I think there is a proper plurality to be had, things like devolution of power, a proper complexity of structures, which allow for a variety of representational means, if you like, which allow for a proper deliberation about the goods we have in common. You know, if everything is centralised in Westminster, how can you really deliberate about goods in common in Northumbria? We see this in the kind of media outcry about postcode lottery and healthcare provision. I'm like, good, you know, actually it might be that in the West Country there's more funding given to care of old people than there is to postnatal provision in West London. I mean, you know, whatever it is. And so I think there has to be proper arenas and a much greater complexity of arenas of deliberation and representation of multiple interests. And part of the problem is, with the kind of sovereignty model we currently have, I'm not saying there isn't a place for sovereignty, but the sovereignty model we currently have in both our parliamentary governance and our corporate governance is a lack of representation of the genuine stakeholders and people who have interests to bear. So, to give you a concrete example, imagine what deliberations about pensions provisions for top executives would be if actually the workers were genuinely represented in senior management, senior board decision-making level. I think that would be a little bit different. And there might have been some checks and balances brought to bear. And there's a wonderful, in the proper parliamentary tradition, which goes right back to Roman law, which predates the Hobbesian vision of sovereignty, of that which affects all should be tested by all. There's a long Latin kind of thing for that, which I won't bore you with, I can't remember it. And I think that we see that same principle in the American Revolution, you know, no taxation without representation, and it's the origins of Parliament. That when the king from the 13th century on would call together the commons and the aristocracy because he wanted to use their money for his own purposes, he had to test what he wanted, consult with them, and because their interests need to be represented, and that's precisely the sin we see played out in both our corporate corruption parliamentary and at a business level, is the use of private ends, of use of public goods for private ends, and a lack of a proper representation of different interests in deliberation about how public goods should be used. And so I'm all for, and I think we need much greater complexity in our political system. There's a second issue you raise, which is about the blurring of, well, say, the social and the political. Now, my understanding of politics is precisely right that something like London Citizens goes to the council and says, we represent these people and asks for deliberation and accountability for the decisions being made. That's a proper, that's what politics properly understood should involve. It's not what we did this morning or we'll do later this evening, just an individual act in a closing session. It's about people acting in concert to protect the things they love. However, I do think there's a genuine problem about the instrumentalisation of social relationships with civil society for political purposes, and how there's a real need, I think, in particular moments, for civil society actors to get political. But the problem is, with a certain kind of protest culture, Germans say they take to the streets, where everything becomes political. So nothing, family relationships, genuine social relations. Nothing is shaking of hands. Everything becomes political, in which case nothing becomes political. There are only certain moments when we have to come together to act politically, bring accountability, and represent our interests. But I don't think that's every moment. So I think what I would agree with you is
is there needs to be much greater clarity about the protection of moral social relationships, but at certain points they must, to defend and uphold them as social moral relationships, we have to get rid of them, or else we lose. Thank you for an important clarification. I think, yes, I mean, primarily it's an analysis of government documents. But I think there is a lot of stuff out there in the literature which sees side-by-side action as simply humanitarian work. It's kind of partial response to immediate human need or clearing up the local park or whatever. Now, I think it's a wonderful place for that, and I'm not against face-to-face dialogue. And I think it's an important place for that, and initiatives such as the Archbishop's involved in, and CC led by Pope. There's a whole variety of fantastic work. But I think there has to be a proper account of the nature of politics and power and the asymmetries of relationship involved in those kinds of endeavours. And so, yes, I think what I'm getting at there is the reduction of side by side work to simply an apolitical kind of social cohesion agenda. And that's huge, as you'll know much better than me. In government policy, and I think it's a big battle to resist this whole use of social cohesion language in which the kind of side-by-side action is fitting, because in social cohesion it's a really apolitical term that is very different from something like civil society, which I would debate, but which precisely allows for institutions, it allows for a critical but constructive relationship with the state and the market, it says that the importance of real social relationships institutions, whereas social cohesion in all the documents, government documents, all of that, is really just a kind of passive, thing at the whim and behest of government policy, and is solely subordinated to the needs of government. Now, that would simply be a category mistake if it wasn't the way in which increasingly, in a whole set of other government agendas, it's linked up to the prevent and counter-terrorism strand. So that anyone who is deemed to be not socially cohesive is rendered an extremist in the de-radicalisation. And that is very, very worrying. And so I think that there's a proper coming together to resist this slightly bland apolitical term and the conceptualisation of side-by-side in those terms. Rather, I think, notions of civil society and precisely the kind of examples that you're advocating are much more to be brought to the fore. And policymakers, you know, need to be upgraded for their either their kind of lack of accuracy or their slightly dodgy connections that they're making. The thing is, it goes back to this relational and unilateral notions of power. I think the view is somehow we have to gain power, to gain the levers of control in order for us to exercise power over people. either through some joining some political elite or through gaining, you know, our voice being the most strongly represented and heard in power decision circles. What I'm proposing is there has to be a proper interaction between relational and unilateral forms of power, that there will be sovereign power, there will be kind of command obedience structures inevitably, especially in large-scale societies. But they can't only do that. And I think the particular role of faith groups within a contemporary context is to recognise their own gift to the body politic, which is a very strong account of relational power, and the refusal of pursuing interests we have in common to selfish interests, but rather say that there are genuinely mutual interests which we all have in common, health and education and these kind of things, which, yes, it is in my self-interest, but that's not an interest which is just a kind of private, selfish gain. That's an interest we have between us, it's a genuinely common, mutual interest. And we have to come together to have a kind of power as exemplified by something like the early labour movement or representing like community organising, in order to seek that mutual interest. And so I think it's the interaction of these two forms of power which needs to take place. We've only really dominated by a single kind of sovereign vision of power, which we as religious people all think, oh, we've got to get as much of that as possible. Instead of saying, no, we just simply refuse that kind of power. That's not our role in this political structure, is to represent and be examples of the thing we're best at, which is coming together and worshiping and care for each other. That's actually what we can do when we pay attention to it quite well. And we end up looking very silly or very violent or rather nasty when we seek after the sovereign power.
I think we've got time for two more questions. So let's take one and two.
I'm a bit concerned about the hospitality concept, not because I'm concerned about the Christians as hosts in this country, but more because I'm concerned about other faiths as guests, because that implies in some respect not belonging, and it implies, and then guests can be at some stage uninvited or unwelcome. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. It might be too much of a semantic point, but I just know, kind of looking historically, especially at the Jewish experience, that being considered as a guest has meant that expulsion is a possibility, persecution is a possibility. So,
it has a dark side. You're trying to think about a robust understanding of hospitality. We have to take account of the reality that, you know, let's face it, lots of religious minorities in this country are not welcomed by lots of people. You know, it's just a reality. Why we deal with the world as it is, or we deal with a kind of fantasy politics. And actually, until we take seriously the dynamics of hospitality, wherein both the stranger and the host have to travel together to a new place to form that new home, and we have also, within hospitality, we have to give an account of the loss for the guest, what they brought home, and the loss for the host. And without a proper account of that grieving process, then a kind of a racist politics or an exclusionary nostalgia take hold. And so I think, yes, there are dangers in the guest-host model, but I think also it does allow us to live in the world as it is, which some religious traditions in this country do have more power, and there is an asymmetry, and that's just a fact. And they can either use that for bad ends, and I think that more often happens when we aren't aware and self-conscious of the power we hold. Train lots of Anglican clergy, and their default position is, I'm just the honest broker, I chair the meeting. No, you've got a stake, you've got an interest, you've got power. When you walk up to local council and knock on the door, he opens it and says, hello. When the local black Pentecostal pastor walks up, he goes, who are you? You know, and that's just a reality. But actually, the Anglican vicar, by going with the Pentecostal pastor, is acting as a good host to who the local councillor considers as a guest or an alien. So I'm just trying to take seriously the work as it is.
Charlie Colchester, the Office of International Diplomacy. Fascinating, Luke. Are you optimistic in the light of what you've said?
I have faith.
Well, that's a delight.
I think there are fantastic initiatives, and I've indicated some of them, and I think the nature of interfaith dialogue is there's some amazing stuff, and the move beyond, let's all be nice to each other, move beyond how are we all really the same, that's no longer the conversation. The conversation is, what are the real differences, but how can we work together? And there are real concrete examples, both across Europe and in this country and in America, of that. But at the same time, it's the earthly city, and there are lots of forces undermining that. But I think we're in, as the Archbishop said, an extraordinary moment. It's kind of an empty space. And you never would have predicted the kind of voices that are going to be heard. And we can't predict that. So for me, it's everything to play for at the moment.
Sorry, Anne Paul, Bible Society. I'm just wondering whether in all of this you aren't nevertheless underestimating the force of the secularist and the secular voice and its place given by the official voice of the state, and whether people don't succumb to your temptations because the secularist agenda really has no hospitality for those areas of serious religious concern, particularly areas where we might say the state has encroached where it should never be, and we should have taken responsibility there anyway, like for the nurture of children. And therefore, how do we conduct the hospitable conversation of with the secularist who has no desire to be hospitable towards faith groups whatsoever? And within government, I think we see quite a lot of that.
No, good question. I mean, I think not all secularists are the same.
No.
Some are more hospitable than others. I have a slightly different reading, I suppose, of the situation. I think it goes back to the Charles Taylor point, that precisely a kind of Dawkins figure, who I have to take some responsibility, my fourth cousin or something. So I think there needs to read what he is doing as a moment when people like him and Hitchens have kind of woken up to the fact that their view isn't simply going to prevail. And it's a kind of, actually, that the space is more contested, and they've got to get out there and contest it. So it's not that there's a kind of a rise of a secularist agenda and we need to be embattled and defensive. It's just a much more contested space. It's like a jacuzzi bubbling up from everywhere, rather than a kind of shower. It's being kind of pouring down on us from one spot. So I think that's the nature of the reality. So it's a defensive. They're as much in a defensive stance. The reality on the ground is, who do they lead? Who do they represent? What's their turnout? Can they get 2,000 people in the room, like London Citizens, which is primarily organised around religious institutions, to hold the mayors, all the mayoral candidates, accountable? I don't see them in the room. I don't see their institutions in the room. So I don't want to be overly defensive about the rest. They might have a certain voice in certain kind of elite circles, but we only have to look down the river to see how quite disconnected many of those elites are from their ordinary working lives of working families. And so I think it's attending those relationships and attending to those relationships and taking seriously the way in which they are quite disconnected from real people, I think actually can give allow a certain tolerance, if you like, and a certain engagement with I think the kind of diminutive of actually what they genuinely, in terms of people, represent.
Thank you very much indeed.
I think we've been very, very well served in this question session, both by the questions and by the answers in the way in which they've been handled. It's been a fascinating conclusion of the evening, and quite clear there are lots more subjects that we address. I think the last point you made was one that we might very well want to take away and ponder. The irony of the last few years has been, I think, that the louder certain kinds of secularists shout in the broad constituency, the more it's clear that theirs is not the default position of every rational person in this country. And that's worth remembering, that they have, in a sense, made it clearer that kind of secularism is precisely one option or others, and not the neutral space that everybody really occupies if anybody gave their minds to it. But I find myself a bit more worried by the other thing that has been very much in the focus of the discussion, and that is the pervasive assumption in government that there is, so to speak, a flat social surface controlled from a single synoptic point above, that society is essentially undifferentiated, and the business of government is to manage that undifferentiated mass. In that undifferentiated mass, there are people who have eccentric private opinions, which, if they insist on, they really can't stop them. But that which I think is implicit in a lot of the present government's attitude to regulation and legislation, which is implicit, sadly, in some of the more kind of cloth-headed approaches to religious pluralism that we've seen, that is, I think, much more the worry than a secularist attack, an anti-religious attack. It's a kind of anthropological and political mistake, which is precisely where we began with Hobbes, which is why I was very glad to hear that question put. What you've been talking about, what I think we're all thinking about even harder now, is the sense that society, so far from being primitively flat and homogeneous, is primitively varied. That is, it's plural, it's interactive, it's argumentative. It doesn't necessarily mean openly conflictual or violent, but it is argumentative and committed to negotiation. Understand that, I think, and we really do have some leverage and some perspective on the present political ills of our society. And I think what you've demonstrated wonderfully for us tonight is what rich resources there are in our theological and practicing traditions to bring to bear on the crisis of our time. And I think I speak for everyone in the room in saying that this has been an exceptionally stretching, inspiring, and informing evening, a deep degree. Thank you very much.